Welcome once again to our program, Salvation History, the New Testament, the Acts of the Apostles, the Epistles, and the Book of Revelation. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, chaplain at the Carmelite Monastery, the entrance of Allendale, and chaplain for John Paul II Catholic High up at 12 Points in Terre Haute. And our series was written by and explained now on series on the radio is Ron Eldred, who is the teacher of religion and history at John Paul II Catholic High for the past 12 years, and has been a wonderful mainstay of the great education going on at John Paul II Catholic High. Ron, welcome back to our series. We're talking about St. Paul specifically. We've been talking about his theology, and we're going into the thought and his theology, kind of how to break down in detail. He's got 14 letters that most scholars admit that Paul wrote, and we've discussed some of them. So what can we say about the best place to find Paul's thought in the Acts of the Apostles or in his 14 letters?
To preface that, we've been discussing, you know, Paul as a theologian, and which, of course, his role, and he's considered the first theologian by many in the church. A theologian is one who interprets the teachings of Jesus, trying to provide a deeper understanding on what Jesus meant and its significance for our lives and things of that sort. So what we're doing here is trying to find out where's the best place in Paul's writings, either in the Acts of the Apostles, which was written by St. Luke, who was a follower of St. Paul, a disciple of St. Paul, or in St. Paul's letters. And I'll go back to Luke Timothy Johnson again, whom we've quoted several times, who's an expert on St. Paul, a Catholic who happens to be one of the world's leading scripture scholars of the New Testament. We'll continue to rely on him for our analysis of St. Paul, at least for a while.
He's very reliable as a Catholic scholar.
Certainly is. And what he says is consistent with what I read in other reliable sources as well. And he says that there has been disagreement among scholars over this issue, but that a reconstruction of Paul's life and theology must use both sources critically, that is, the Acts and his letters. The Acts are the primary source for the facts of his life. And, of course, when we were talking about the facts of Paul's life, you know, we went right through the Acts, all the way from chapter 1 through the last chapter, whereas the letters are primarily where his thought is to be found. Although you can find out a little bit about his life and this, that, and the other from the letters. And we, from time to time, had to refer to the letters as we were talking about his life. But now we're going to be focusing more and more on his letters, especially his letter to the Romans and maybe the Galatians and the 1st and 2nd Corinthians.
All right, well, this brings us to the question then, and you indicated a little, which of his letters are the best sources for determining his thought or his religious thinking?
Well, as Johnson points out, this depends on which of the 14 letters. And we're assuming that Paul had something to do with all 14 letters. He wrote seven of them for sure. All scripture scholars, for the most part, agree with that. There's at least another four that most scripture scholars think that he wrote. And there's three that most scripture scholars think that he didn't, but they were written by disciples of his or followers of his. And then there's one, the Hebrews, which most scripture scholars believe that he didn't write. But nonetheless, it does depend on which of the 14 letters he actually wrote. And there has been a lot of debate among scripture scholars over this matter, as we know. Johnson informs us that the authorship of at least six letters has been challenged on the basis of style, placement in Paul's career, and consistency in theme. He says that the conventional position is that seven letters were written by Paul during his lifetime, which are Romans, Galatians, Philemon, Philippians, 1 and 2 Corinthians, and 1 Thessalonians. And that three additional ones have been some claimed authenticity, 2 Thessalonians, Colossians, and Ephesians. And that three of them are certainly written by others in his name, specifically 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus. Father Felix Jest, whom we've also quoted several times in this series, he is a leading scripture scholar, a Jesuit. He's another prominent Catholic scholar. He is in substantial agreement with Johnson on this matter. Johnson says that an alternative view is that Paul's might not have actually written all the letters, but did author all of them, perhaps using a scribe or, you know, a secretary to write them. And so he would have dictated. If he didn't actually write the letter, okay, he dictated it, and then the secretary would put it in his own words.
Oh.
The alternative allows us to use all the letters as sources for his thought or theology. In other words, what Johnson is saying here is, if Paul may have actually written some with his own hand, but others, he would have dictated to some secretary or a scribe. And then the scribe, of course, would have, you know, would have put it to some extent in their own words. And so I suppose it depends upon how close the scribe, you know, actually wrote down what he thought St. Paul said as to how accurate.
Well, but the church, knowing that, nevertheless has canonized the letters of Paul or accepted them as worthy of including in the New Testament.
But as we'll see as we go along, they're very, very hard to interpret. And that's okay. And that's one of the reasons, of course, there have been so much debate over the centuries about what St. Paul meant.
And, of course, even St. Peter says that.
Oh, yes.
Some of the things in St. Paul is awfully hard to understand what he meant in his letters.
Yes.
Okay. Well, well said there. You said that St. Paul's life can be ascertained from the Acts of the Apostles, the facts from the Acts, and his thoughts from the letters. You want to comment on that?
Well, as we've already done, we traced Paul's life and missionary work as outlined in the Acts. We spent almost, you know, a good part of this series on that. And only occasionally did we refer to the letters for this type of information. However, as soon as we start to, and we're starting that now, to examine his thought or theology, we have to begin looking at his letters more and less at Acts. In regard to constructing Paul's life, we followed the Acts beginning with chapters 7 through 28. From these chapters, we traced the outline of his life, beginning with his early life in Tarsus, and how Greco-Roman culture and Judaism influenced his intellectual and spiritual development. Then we discussed his training as a Pharisee in Jerusalem under the direction of the famous Rabbi Gamaliel. Following this, we looked at his persecution of the Christian church, followed by a treatment of his miraculous conversion on the road to Damascus. We completed our discussion of Paul from the Acts by considering his three missionary journeys, during which time he established numerous local churches in Greece and Asia Minor, Asia Minor being modern-day Turkey. While discussing these topics, we considered the various letters wherever appropriate. Johnson states that these letters are occasional, they're official, they are various in form and rhetorical style, and they result from a complex process of composition. He says that the Acts and Paul's letters disagree on some points concerning Paul's movements, but agree on the basic patterns of his ministry. He tells us that Paul preferred to advise churches he founded, mostly in big cities, through personal visits to them. But if this were impossible, he would send delegates, and only as a last result did Paul sit down and actually write letters. In fact, a number of his letters were written when he was in prison. So obviously he couldn't go visit them at the time.
Okay. What can you tell us, Ron, about the composition of these letters, or epistles, as they are often called? That reminds me that the teacher asked the kids in school, what is an epistle, referring to these letters of St. Paul? And one of the kids said, an epistle is the wife of an apostle. So, just in passing. Anyway, what about these letters?
Well, an epistle is meant a formal letter. So Johnson states that Paul's letters are official and not written for personal news or entertainment, but as messages from an apostle to the Church of God, or his delegates in a certain place, which would technically make them epistles rather than just simply letters. He informs us that Paul composed his letters as he was almost constantly on the move, which determined that his letters are occasional and that they were written in response to real situations rather than as a vehicle for systematic theology. So when we read the epistles, we're not going to find, you know, like a textbook of theology. You got to dig it out. It's buried in different places. Johnson also says that Paul's letters are complex in composition, make use of community traditions, and are written with the help of secretaries and co-sponsors. Furthermore, his letters share certain formal structural features, but they differ in length, style, and rhetorical type.
Okay, what can you tell us then about the structure of Paul's letters, since they are complex?
Well, Father Felix Just, a Jesuit whom we quoted several times, he's a leading scripture scholar, a renowned biblical scholar, he tells us that most ancient letters followed a standard format or structure, much like our formal letters do today, and that Paul pretty much followed that format. For example, his letters always have a beginning that tells whom the letter is from, to whom the letter is written, a formal greeting of grace or peace, and a thanksgiving or blessing that gives thanks to God for something about the recipients, such as their faith, hope, their love of God and neighbor, or the good example they give for other Christians. Then the body of the letter follows containing an initial exhortation, thesis statement, a theological discussion of some sort, and some form of moral admonition. And then he concludes his letter with practical matters, individual greetings, a personal postscript, and a doxology, or a prayer praising God or blessing the believers to whom he is writing. Father Just states that Paul's letters are usually co-authored and are addressed to a specific group of people in the Christian community, and don't always follow the exact sequence that I just listed here. Also, Paul's letters are named for the persons to whom the letter is being sent.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that statement there, Ron. Father Just states that Paul's letters are usually co-authored.
Yes, co-authored.
What does that mean?
Well, if you look at some of the letters, you'll see that it also includes there's someone else there you can tell.
Yes, sometimes kind of involved.
Yes, involved. And sometimes he even mentions them by name.
Okay. All right. Common practice of the day was to collect and republish the letters of famous people like Paul.
Yes, that's right. Father Just informs us that there were probably multiple copies made and distributed to several different Christian communities. Much like papal encyclicals are sent to all the bishops today, or like people send out Christmas letters to all their friends at once, that in this process, shorter letters were sometimes combined or other editorial changes made. For example, if some community got one of St. Paul's letters, it's very likely that the local bishop there or the priest that was in charge would have other scribes, you know, make other copies, and then they would distribute these copies to other churches and maybe even to some private individuals. For example, he says that, Father Just says that what is normally called the second letter of Paul to the Corinthians might be a compilation of what originally had two to five separate letters. Similar, some scholars think that Paul's letter to the Philippians is a later compilation of three originally separate letters. Some editor came, you know, along later and put these three letters together.
Okay.
Once these letters circulated, they were read aloud at liturgical celebrations.
Okay, that's another whole effort to determine what are the true copies and what aren't true copies, and that's another effort. It takes all kind of educated study, so we're not getting into that detail right now.
Well, we had a series where we went into that, and it would be a type of what we call external criticism or lower criticism.
Okay.
Biblical criticism.
Validating the authenticity of the various scriptures. Well, in addition to St. Paul's letters, the New Testament contains several letters called the Catholic epistles, or the general letters. Can you say something about these?
Father Just claims that these letters are usually called the general letters, or Catholic epistles, not because they were written for or by the Roman Catholic Church, but because the word Catholic means universal. In other words, the letters were intended for a general audience and not some specific individual or some specific church. The last seven letters of the New Testament and the brief letter cited in Acts 15 are slightly different from the Pauline letters in form and structure. Yet they still follow the general conventions of ancient letters. And these include James, 1st and 2nd Peter, 1st and 2nd and 3rd John, Jude, and Acts 15, chapter 15, verses 23 to 29. I was never aware of that was a separate letter until I started doing the research for this series. Father Just tells us that most of them were not written to a specific individual or community, but are addressed to a more general readership. Therefore, unlike Paul's letters, the Catholic letters are named for the apostle who wrote it, or at least to whom it is attributed, since the authorship of some of those letters is disputed today.
Okay, you mentioned a while ago that the authorship of some of Paul's letters have been challenged by biblical scholars.
Going back to Luke Timothy Johnson, informs us that most scholars today think that the three letters, 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus, weren't written by Paul, but by others using his name at least 100 years after his death, which represents a later development of Christianity. As we discussed in our series, Interpreting the Bible Through the Ages, these and other books of the New Testament were regarded as having been written by the evangelist and Paul until the 19th century. For example, in 1807, Friedrich Schleiermacher, whom we had a lot to say about in that series, challenged the authenticity of 1 Timothy. And we spent some time considering how he and other 19th century German Protestant biblical scholars tried to prove that the New Testament was created by a later generation of Christians, and he and others offered a substitute Christianity with their religion of the heart, rather than a religion of the Bible or of an institutional church with sacraments, you know, and an organizational hierarchy and that kind of thing. By the end of the 19th century, the three pastorals, that is those three letters that we talked about a while ago, 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus, had become and have remained most widely regarded as pseudonymous today.
In other words, they really weren't written by the people that claimed to write.
That's right. They were written by someone else. But still considered canonical or inspired by the church, no matter who wrote them.
Okay. On what grounds have these scholars concluded that these and other Pauline letters are inauthentic?
Johnson identifies several criteria used to determine the inauthenticity of these letters. And by inauthenticity, you're talking about who they were attributable to, that they weren't, as you mentioned a while ago, weren't attributable to the person's name that's on the letter. Somebody else wrote it later on. Reasons, that they say this, some scripture scholars, they are difficult to place in Paul's career, as described by Acts and other letters. Two, they have distinctive stylistic elements with a much more Hellenistic, that is Greek, sound and vocabulary than is found in Paul's other letters. And a third, they seem to differ from the standard Pauline treatment of theology and ethics. For example, they discuss faith, hope, and love, but these themes are treated with a slightly different tone according to these scholars that claim that these three letters inauthentic, that is, not written by Paul, but by someone else. Paul's male-female egalitarianism seems to have vanished, such as Paul's earlier disapproval of women speaking in the assembly and blaming it everything on Eve. In other words, supposedly in some of Paul's earlier letters, you know, he's very negative about, supposedly negative about women and what have you as a male chauvinist and all that kind of thing. But on the other hand, in these three letters, if Paul actually wrote them, he's really changed a lot, because you don't see this kind of negativity, supposed negativity, in these later letters. So modern scholars have assumed that somebody else wrote them and not Paul.
Oh, I see. Okay, but again, we might say, to help our listening audience, regardless of who wrote the letters, the church has incorporated them and accepted them as authentic teaching. And that, so if they're in the Bible, we can accept them as included in the revelation from God, even though we may not know exactly who the author is.
Yeah, maybe not authentic in the sense that Paul wrote them, but authentic in the sense that somebody wrote them that the church recognizes.
And accepted these as real, authentic teachings.
Right.
That fit into the Christian message. I think that's really important. Some scholars believe that these Pauline letters were written in the 2nd century than in during Paul's lifetime.
Yes, as we demonstrated in our series, Interpreting the Bible Through the Ages, certain 19th century Protestant biblical scholars, such as Schleiermacher and many others, and a few Catholic ones at the turn of the century, such as Loisy and Tyrrell, they tried to undermine Christian religion so as to replace it with a religion of the heart, a religion that stressed emotion, feelings, intuition, and things of that sort, rather than doctrines and church institutions and things like that. For these and other reasons, Luke Timothy Johnson, maintains that, quote, the pastoral letters are regarded as second century versions of a domesticated Paulinism because, and he gives several reasons, they take Paul as their hero and carry forward some real Pauline themes. They represent an adaptation to a less eschatological, more worldly Christianity. Eschatological means, you know, the end times.
Okay.
And so supposedly in these letters, St. Paul had emphasized the end times a lot more in his earlier letters, but in these letters, no, not so. In particular, they structured the church along the lines of a patriarchal household. And finally, 2 Timothy provides a biographical setting for the handing down of tradition from a first to a second generation. And finally, Timothy and Titus establish guidelines for a conservative version of Pauline Christianity.
Okay, well now, however, doesn't Luke Timothy Johnson offer the hypothesis that they are real letters with separate purposes?
Yes, he does. He claims that these letters, these three letters, especially 1 Timothy, show that the elements of organization found in these letters are fully consonant with the situations faced by Paul in the first generation and resemble the structure of the church found in his other letters much more than they resemble the structure of the mid-second century church. In other words, Johnson's going to be defending the thesis that Paul probably wrote these letters, even though, you know, scholars have detected some differences in them. He goes on to maintain that the three letters to Paul's representatives can be regarded as real letters written under Paul's authorization, at least, during his lifetime. He says that, quote, the criteria used to determine authenticity are deeply flawed, that is, by these scholars who are claiming, you know, that these are not written by Paul, relying on the device of treating all three letters as a single unit while ignoring the diversity in the undisputed letters. that once the letters are treated individually, they resemble other letters in the collection. For example, 2 Timothy and Philippians are very similar. You know, 2 Timothy is one of the ones that they're claiming, you know, that wasn't written by Paul. And, of course, Philippians is one that most scripture scholars believe was written by Paul. But Johnson's saying is there isn't any real significant difference, you know, in a lot of ways between the two letters about different issues, different matters that Paul treats. And 1 Timothy deals with a range of issues much like those in 1 Corinthians. Again, 1 Timothy is one of those letters that a lot of modern scholars consider to be inauthentic, not written by Paul. Well, on the other hand, almost all scripture scholars agree that he wrote 1 Corinthians. But on the other hand, Johnson's saying is that Paul pretty well deals with both subjects in a very similar fashion in both of these letters. Moreover, Titus deals with a situation that closely resembles Galatians. Johnson states that the question of community structures is a perfect test case of whether these letters are much different from Paul's other letters.
Okay, now this may sound very complicated, and I think we have to keep our focus on the fact that the reason we're going into some of this is because people are trying to take authority and question the validity of the scriptures. And most people are going to read the Bible that are listening to us are probably just saying, well, I don't really have to know all that because there are scholars who deal with all those things and have answered all those objections. So we've got the intellectual firepower available to answer all these questions that the Bible really shouldn't be believed, or is not worthy of following and the like. And these are just some efforts to help us see that there are great studies to defend and explain all these objections that are constantly coming up against the scriptures.
Well, to give you an example, there's some people I know right now who are working on a certificate for teaching catechism. One of the courses they had to take was a course on the Bible, on interpreting the Bible. And the textbook that they have read or had to read for this, actually several textbooks, they asked me to help them because they were running into this kind of modern kind of interpretation time and time again, and it was really upsetting them. There have been a lot of people who have had their faith undermined by this kind of scripture scholarship, or some people even had their faith destroyed by it. And so I think it's important that people know where a lot of these people are coming from. You don't have to know theology and philosophy to get to heaven.
Sure.
But on the other hand, it does help, in the world we live where so much reason is used to try to disprove faith rather than show that the two are compatible. I think it's important to
well said, bring that out. Ron, to our listening audience, may God bless you all, always, and in all ways.